This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the U.S. looks for more action against the Islamic State. Human rights advocates condemn China. A carbon game puts players in climate negotiators' shoes.
I like to make the game simple so that people can grasp the problem within 30 minutes.
A British pop star keeps breaking records. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. The U.S. Defense Department says recent U.S.-led coalition airstrikes in Syria and Iraq have killed three senior Islamic State leaders, including the extremist group's financial chief. Coalition spokesman Steve Warren said Thursday Abu Salah was responsible for coordinating the group's extortion activities. He calls Salah one of Islamic State's most experienced leaders and said his death will disrupt its financing. The spokesman also said coalition airstrikes have killed 350 Islamic State fighters in the Iraqi city of Ramadi. On Wednesday, U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter said the international community has to step up the fight against Islamic State before another terrorist attack like last month's assault in Paris. He told the Senate Armed Forces Committee the U.S. asked about 40 countries for more contributions, including special operations forces and weapons. Ambassador James Jeffrey is a former senior diplomat to Baghdad and now with the Washington Institute on Near East Affairs. Ambassador Jeffrey told International Edition's Victor Beatty he was encouraged by the Carter testimony.
It's a step in the right direction, but we have to get beyond this idea that this war is all about what we will not do. This war has to be what we have to do, which is to take ground back from ISIS. Ramadi is the target right now. The last 98 kilometers of the Turkish border that ISIS controls is next. Eventually, there's Mosul and Raqqa. That's the only way we're going to defeat this scourge. And what ISIS is doing is an extraordinary the effect. I just got finished reading that the Kurds are under tremendous pressure. Their economy is being crushed, among other things, by the Russians constantly closing the airspace to fire cruise missiles over Kurdistan territory. Well, Baghdad, of course, is not too unhappy with that because they find Kurdistan to be difficult, so they're not going to block the Russian overflight clearance, and the Russians would do it anyway. But it's, of course, the only justification for it is supposedly to hit ISIS, although they're not attacking ISIS, of course. But this is just another indication of how not just ISIS is totally destabilizing the globe through its terrorist attacks and its occupation of territory, but this unholy alliance of Iran, Syria, and Russia claiming to be fighting ISIS is basically pulling apart the security structures of the Middle East. In some areas, special forces and attack helicopters might be enough. That's Ramadi. In other areas, Raqqa and Mosul, I don't think so.
Mr. Carter, when pressed about a larger U.S. ground presence in the area, suggested that the fragile coalition that is fighting ISIS may, in fact, turn against the U.S. forces.
That's a particular concern about the Shia militias. And the way to do that is, one, make it clear that we're only going in there to seize terrain, not to hold terrain, not to be an occupying force. Two, to make it clear to these people and to the Iranians that the United States sees a real threat from ISIS to our NATO allies. Look at Turkey and France and the hundreds of people that have been killed in ISIS attacks. But now look at us, and that we're going to do what's necessary to take them down.
Ambassador James Jeffrey, former U.S. senior diplomat to Baghdad, also says the call for Turkey and Gulf Arab states to do more to fight the Islamic State threat in the region is not credible because they can only make a marginal contribution with small and untested forces. Staying in the Middle East, it looks like we continue to see the aftermath of billionaire Donald Trump's proposal on banning Muslim immigration. International Edition social media correspondent G. Abby Lee joins me with details. Hello, G.
Hi, Ray. One of the trending stories on Facebook is how an international department store chain dropped its line of products immediately after the comment. That department store is Dubai-based Landmark that has 190 stores in the Middle East, Africa, and Pakistan. Landmark announced it would pull all Trump merchandise off its shelves, and judging by media reports, the move is already taking place.
Well, that's quite interesting. People didn't waste any time, but which media outlets are reporting, and what are some of the details?
So the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times were the first to cover it. The NYT article is titled, Donald Trump Loses Luster When Words Reach the Middle East. The Landmark Group removed all Trump-branded products from the shelves of its home furnishing store just hours after he called for a ban on the entry of Muslims into the U.S. The foundation of Trump's business is his name, so when people don't like him, his business is going to suffer. The Trump brand is used in a wide range of industries, from upscale golf courses and residences to accessories.
Certainly a symbol of American success in a big way, I guess. But how is Trump taking in all of this news now?
Well, he didn't tweet about it at all, but he did send out a number of tweets about the latest poll conducted by CBS News and the New York Times. And that may be related to the immigration policy proposal. It reads like this. Thank you for your support. Being hashtag politically correct will not hashtag make America great again. The latest poll result shows Trump leading the Republican nomination at 35%, followed by Ted Cruz and Ben Carson with 16 and 13%. Ray?
Thanks, Chi. She tweets from our Twitter account at VOA underscore IE and from her own account at Gabby Lee. That's JEEABBEYLEE. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views, presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar at voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. A fundraising campaign started by Muslim Americans to help the families of those killed in last week's mass shooting in San Bernardino, California, has raised about $175,000. Faisal Kazi, a neurologist who works for a private nonprofit organization in San Bernardino, began a local online campaign called Muslims United for San Bernardino on the crowdfunding website LaunchGood, which is dedicated to assisting Muslim initiatives in the United States and abroad. As the campaign neared its initial fundraising goal, Kazi and his friends took the campaign national, and donations to the LaunchGood website rose dramatically, with many large donations coming from Muslim American advocacy groups. Tariq El Masidi, the campaign's fundraising director, says another goal of the campaign is to show the public that Muslim Americans are active contributors to American society. Meanwhile, the investigation continues into the shooting by Syed Rizwan Farouk and his wife Tashreen Malik. They killed 14 people and wounded 21 others. VOA's Ken Bredemeyer spoke with International Edition host Susan Yaki.
Authorities now seem to be focusing a lot on, first of all, how Tashreen Malik was radicalized in Pakistan. And her husband as well, but also a friend of Farouk's, a next-door neighbor, lived near him for several years and is believed to have sold or given the weapons, a couple of the automatic weapons that Farouk and his wife used to kill the 14 people. What's their relationship? For one thing, this man, Enrique Marquez, is telling investigators that he and Farouk planned a 2012 terrorist action of some sort, but got cold feet, backed out, for the simple reason that authorities at the time were arresting other people in other plots, and they got worried that they were could be in the crosshairs of the Federal Bureau of Investigation as well. So that plot didn't happen, but certainly U.S. investigators want to know more about it.
Now they believe this couple was radicalized long before the shooting.
Not only before the shooting, before they got married. One of the original theories of the case was that perhaps the woman in this case, Tashfeen Malik, had radicalized her husband. That seems not to be the case as investigators delve further into it, that they both were radicalized, that they both had a sense of wanting to commit some kind of a terrorist action. As they met online, as they got to know each other, they dated, if you will, courted each other, and got married, came to the U.S.
Is there any sign the pair were actually part of an organized terror organization?
Federal authorities don't seem to think so. That question has been raised repeatedly, and investigators have not uncovered something in that vein at this point. They believe that the two were self-radicalized and came to be a joint husband and wife assault team carrying out this massacre in California last week.
That's VOA's Ken Bredemeyer speaking with International Edition's Susan Yockey. Thursday was International Human Rights Day, a commemoration of the date in 1948 when the UN General Assembly adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, a milestone document outlining basic international rights norms. A UN committee marked the occasion to slam China's human rights situation, especially regarding lawyers. Prominent human rights lawyer Pu Chicheng, who's defended artist Ai Weiwei, will go on trial next week. International Edition's Sarah Williams talked with Sophie Richardson, China director at Human Rights Watch.
The UN's Committee Against Torture has issued a pretty scathing indictment of China's record on that subject in particular, and it makes some very strong recommendations about eradicating torture by, first of all, minimizing the amount of time somebody can be held before they're brought before a judge so that they aren't held by the police for more than a month at a time. It also urges that they have access to a lawyer from the moment they're deprived of liberty. It calls for an end to the use of restraints, solitary confinement, investigations about abuses of North Koreans or Tiananmen survivors. It's a very thoroughgoing and historical document. And if the Chinese government was serious about eradicating torture, it would follow that roadmap.
It seems as though human rights lawyers, at least within the last, you know, it means for a while, but certainly within this past year, the past few months, have been singled out for a special treatment by Chinese authorities.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There was a remarkable, really unprecedented roundup of human rights lawyers across China between July and September. And more than 20 of those people are still detained and or disappeared. And it doesn't seem to be enough for the authorities to prevent these people from doing their work and taking cases to court. They've also really stepped up public rhetoric, demonizing the very idea of using courts as a way of protecting human rights. And I think that's a pretty alarming regression from where we were about a decade ago.
A prominent human rights lawyer, Pu Zhicheng, is apparently will be tried next week. He has been detained, I believe, for quite a while, but he is also one of China's most prominent human rights lawyers.
Yeah, he's really the canary in the coal mine, I think, for this community these days. He's a very well-known, very well-regarded lawyer who has worked on, you know, some very high-profile cases on issues ranging from religious freedom to labor rights. He has been detained for about a year and a half now, which is, of course, wildly beyond what law and procedure should allow. And he is scheduled to be tried on Monday, largely on the basis of some online postings, all of which were entirely within the confines of peaceful expression as guaranteed by Chinese and international law. And we're really encouraging global attention to the outcome of this case, because I think if he is found guilty, you know, then really nobody is safe anymore in this realm of activism.
Sophie Richardson, China Director at Human Rights Watch, speaking with International Edition's Sarah Williams. Delegates from 196 countries meeting in a Paris suburb face a Friday deadline to reach a wide-ranging climate agreement, but hurdles over money and targets remain large. A 29-page draft of the agreement shows differences remain substantial, especially on key questions involving the responsibility of richer nations to fund climate change programs for poorer countries. While negotiators also wrangle over who will cut their carbon emissions and by how much, the rest of us may soon be able to play along at home. VOA's Steve Barragona takes a look at what's called the carbon game.
If you're wondering why striking a climate deal has been so hard, play a round of the carbon game. It's a video board game that Radboud University researcher Linda Carton and her colleagues are developing. Carton spoke by Skype.
I like to make the game simple so that people can grasp the problem within 30 minutes.
The game divides the world into six blocks. The four top emitters, China, the United States, Europe, and India, and the rest, partitioned into developed and developing countries. Each block starts the game with coins representing the greenhouse gas emissions it's currently expected to emit through 2100.
It's a simple assignment. Try to limit your emissions to 2 degrees.
That's the maximum warming that experts say the planet can take without catastrophic consequences. What's not simple is how to do it. The game begins with enough carbon on the table to raise the temperature by 4.5 degrees. That's the high end of current projections.
So then we say, well, let's negotiate. It's your floor now. Who starts leading the world towards a low carbon future?
Players do so at their own peril. Lowering carbon emissions lowers their GDP per capita as well. So you'll often hear this around the table.
It's not my turn. Let somebody else, take away the hard part. So they hope that in the end they can do a little bit of free riding.
But the other players are going to notice.
Everybody blames and shames you that you are the free rider of the game.
Cuts hurt some players worse than others, depending on how carbon intensive their economies are. Here's what happened at one game played here at the Paris Climate Summit.
The woman who played India made a big pledge. And then she saw what she did to the GDP per capita. And then she said, oh, no, put it back. You know, my people cannot take this.
And here's how that game ended.
Oh, we sacrificed the Indian economy and all the people living there, but we saved the world.
Carton says it's a powerful message for players.
The lesson is that it's a very long way down, 4.5 degrees to 2 degrees. And we all need to reduce our emissions, and we need to look at each other and saying, it's your turn.
In a later round, players can aim for a happier ending by investing in renewable energy. The game is still under development, but Carton and her colleagues want to use it as a teaching tool for their younger students.
I want to educate them about the magnitude of the task that's ahead of us for their generation of emission reduction. Because you have to reduce emissions like 80% worldwide, that's not a small thing.
She also hopes to develop a smartphone app so people can play Climate Negotiator anywhere. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Paris.
Coming up, a British pop star finds magic with 25. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
This is VOA's International Edition. The role of nonprofit organizations in addressing world poverty is the focus of an exhibit based on a book by the journalists Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudun. The book and exhibit in Los Angeles show how people can have an impact on the world around them. VOA's Michael Sullivan has more.
Cheryl Wudun says the book, A Path Appears, which she co-wrote with her husband, looks at groups that help children and their families. The book was published last year, and the exhibit has just opened at the Skirball Cultural Center, a Jewish museum that highlights the democratic process. The title for both comes from the Chinese writer Lu Xun.
And he said that hope is like a path in the countryside. At first, there is nothing. As more and more people walk back and forth, a path appears. We have those paths to solutions now.
The exhibit shows innovative devices like the Hippo water roller, which is sold by a social enterprise in South Africa. The rolling drum carries 90 liters of water and can be maneuvered by a child. Another device, called the Peepoo, is a biodegradable bag toilet that addresses the lack of sanitation in some communities. A solar pack in a suitcase provides lighting in others, and free soccer balls given to young people carry a message about stopping the spread of AIDS. One group featured in the exhibit, called Chrysalis, helps the homeless in Los Angeles. Chief Executive Mark Laranger says homelessness is a multifaceted problem and that Chrysalis targets the issue through classes and on-the-job training.
Employment, of course, is a huge piece of this. We need to make sure that those men and women that are ready, willing, and able to work have an opportunity to do that.
Other organizations featured in the exhibit focus on education, including the tuition-free Kibera School for Girls in Nairobi, Kenya, and South Central Scholars, a Los Angeles charity that helps inner-city students succeed in college. The Fielding School of Public Health at the University of California, Los Angeles, contributed data for the exhibit that showed disparities in gender equality and childhood health and education, illustrating through graphic charts which countries offer free education through secondary school or ban child marriage. UCLA's Neil Baer, a physician and television producer, was guest curator for the exhibit and says visitors can get involved right away through a website called Action Lab.
Action Lab is here, literally, at the end of the exhibit, and after you go through and see about 40 different organizations and their power in changing people's lives, we give you actionable steps you can take to get involved.
He says the message of the exhibit is that each of us can make a difference. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
British pop singer Adele is breaking new records as her latest album, 25, is a huge hit with fans and topping the music charts. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald joined International Edition's Jim Stevenson to talk about the phenomenal success.
Hello, it's me.
Adele just debuted at number one on next week's Billboard Top 200 Pop Albums chart after selling 3.38 million first-week copies of 25. And that's a historic figure. It's the biggest total in the history of Nielsen SoundScan. That's the point-of-purchase sales tracking system, started way back in 1991. And this is also significant because Adele didn't allow streaming of 25. These are direct sales and downloads. And she's also poised for a million-selling second week, which would also make chart history, because that hasn't happened in the 24-year history of SoundScan.
Well, we've talked a lot about Taylor Swift being very shrewd in the business end of music, and it appears that Adele is following in those footsteps.
Adele is very shrewd because she went away for a while. She lay low. She didn't overexpose herself on social media. She made us want her back. And this is how the public is responding. But, you know, there's a price for everything. And in Adele's case, that price is taxes. Because just this week, the British government hit her with a £4 million tax bill for 2014. That works out to about $6 million U.S. dollars. Now, Adele didn't really do anything in 2014. She was home, you know, writing and recording 25, raising her little boy, laying low. But she still gets that huge tax bill because of royalties from the sales of 21, which came out in 2011 and dominated the year's markets. And she also had big success in 2012 with the James Bond theme Skyfall. Now, Adele's estimated net worth is about 50 million pounds, or about $75 million. So it's not like she's going to be penniless because of this tax bill. But if she wants to raise a few extra pounds, she can always hit the road. And that's what's going to happen. She's going to kick off her world tour on February 29th, 2016, in Belfast, Northern Ireland. Right now, we have the UK and European tour dates, but we're going to have to wait a little longer to see when she hits North America.
The fact that Adele hasn't streamed this effort, do you see this as perhaps becoming a template for other artists?
Well, of course, Taylor Swift led the charge last year with her 1989 album, and she wanted to bring attention to royalty payments, to how small they seemed in these streaming services, and she definitely put that on the table. Streaming is still relatively new. The royalty structure is evolving. Adele can get away with it because she sells so many albums the old-fashioned way. Mm-hmm. Other artists, it's not so easy for them. Streaming is the wave of the future, it seems, and they have to play the game.
We play the game each and every week with Ray McDonald, who is your Top 20 Countdown host. Find him on Twitter at
Ray on the Hits.
Thanks so much for stopping by, Ray.
Thanks, Jim.
Hello. How are you? It's so typical of me to talk.
And that'll do it for this edition of International Edition. More news, features, videos, and podcasts all on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
High-level representatives of nearly 200 countries have assembled in Paris to hammer out a global agreement to hold back rising temperatures. By most estimates, if global temperature rise more than 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, the results may well be catastrophic and irreversible. 14 of the 15 warmest years on record have occurred since the year 2000, and 2015 is on pace to be the warmest year of all, said President Barack Obama at the Paris Conference's first session. No nation, large or small, wealthy or poor, is immune to what this means. So what must be done? First, all major economies must put forward decisive national actions that will reduce their emissions and begin to turn the corner on climate change, said the president. Already, nations responsible for most of the global emissions have set their targets. By 2030, the European Union will cut its emissions by 40% from 1990 levels. The U.S. will cut its emissions by 26% to 28% from 2005 levels by 2025. And China's emissions will peak by 2030. The president also called for a mechanism to review countries' commitments and financing to help developing countries address climate change. In essence, said U.S. Special Envoy for Climate Change Todd Stern, the idea is to accelerate the transformation of the energy base of the global economy from high to low carbon. The good news is that we are already moving in that direction, said President Obama.
Last year, the global economy grew while global carbon emissions from burning fossil fuels stayed flat. We've proved that strong economic growth and a safer environment no longer have to conflict with one another. They can work in concert with one another.
There is such a thing as being too late, and when it comes to climate change, that hour is almost upon us, said President Obama. But if we act here, if we act now, if we place our own short-term interests behind the air that our young people will breathe, and the food that they will eat, and the water that they will drink, and the hopes and dreams that sustain their lives, then we won't be too late for them.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.